Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
You're listening to Pit Pass F1. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is a special episode ahead of the Chinese Grand Prix. Pit Pass F1 is brought to you by Evergreen Podcasts, and this week Formula One returns to Shanghai for the first time after a five-year pandemic hiatus. Formula One's changed so much since its last visit in 2019 that it's almost unrecognisable. Having laboured for popularity around a decade ago, Liberty Media's purchase of the commercial rights in 2017 has seen the sport gradually transformed into what today is a global entertainment behemoth. More people are watching the sport than ever before. But how exactly has F1 boomed in those 5 years? Well, on today's special episode of Pit Pass F1, I chat to the authors of a brand new book that attempts to stitch together F1's enthusiastic history with its high-rolling present to describe just what it's taken to turn the sport into a worldwide sensation. It's called The Formula: How Rogues, Geniuses, and Speed Freaks Re-engineered F1 into the World's Fastest-Growing Sport. It's available now wherever you get your favourite books, and its authors, Wall Street Journal sports reporters Joshua Robinson and Jonathan Clegg, join me now. John, Josh, it's good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, congratulations on the book. I really enjoyed it, particularly the culmination of the book, both in Abu Dhabi 2021 and then, of course, the inaugural Las Vegas Grand Prix at the end of last season. But before we get into that, I want to start with you guys in particular, because so much of F1 history is about debate and discussion about when you started watching the sport. So when did you guys get involved in Formula One for the first time? What's your history with the sport?
So both of us grew up in the UK, in the 80s and 90s, during, I think, the first real peak of the sport, when it did seem to be everywhere for the first time, when you had the great rivalries of Prost and Senna, you had all of the good teams were very British in a way that, even the British ones aren't today. And it was just like appointment viewing in the UK in those days. So, that was kind of how both of us got hooked initially. And then, as interest ebbed a little bit, I think it's, fair to say that a lot of people kind of got a bit more detached from it. And then in the modern era, it's like cultural relevance came back in such a huge way that we thought we really needed to tell the story of how we got here.
Yeah, we're both Williams early 1990s fans. Don't really, once you become a sports journalist, you kind of leave your, partisan followings of teams behind. But certainly the days of Damon Hill, Nigel Mansell are the sort of glory days that I remember from childhood.
I want to ask you today mostly about where you see the sport standing right now in its present guise, but the book travels through from the beginning of Formula One history via a series of historical episodes through to present day, including a handful of seminal moments and historical highlights. So maybe a bit of a broad question to start off with, and starting with you, Josh, but to your mind, if you could pick only one of those historical episodes, which is most useful in describing where Formula One is today?
That's a good question. But, I think at the very end, the one of the reasons we finished with Las Vegas is just because it seemed to encapsulate everything that F1 has become in its kind of more American-focused era. We describe in the book its many kind of false starts in America, where they tried in Detroit, they tried in Phoenix and got outdrawn by an ostrich festival. They had the initial fiascos in Vegas, where they raced in the parking lot of Caesar's Palace. And it was after all that frustration that Bernie kind of decided, the real growth opportunity is east, not west. But to see the way Liberty came in, saw America as a completely untapped market and as the real place where F1 could take the next step into global relevance, You know, they did that in such a short time and culminated with this absolutely spectacular show in Vegas that was so over the top and so glitzy and so kind of fan servicey in many ways that that kind of informs a lot about where the sport has come.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, to go back even further, I think, like, you know, if you look at, you know, Bernie Eccleston's sort of entrance into the sport and the way that he, well, basically took control of the sport from everyone else without too much of a fight. But if you look back at what Formula One was, you know, in the late 1970s, it sort of informs a lot about, you know, where the sport has moved under Liberty. And I think some of the sort of central, you know, dynamic and sort of friction that exists because, you know, back before Bernie became involved, Formula One was still a very sort of amateurish sport, sort of imbued with the spirit of kind of invention and a sort of like, you know, guy with a wrench in a garage type mentality where it literally was, you know, sort of enthusiastic amateurs, you know, sort of assembling these sort of magnificent driving machines in their own garages and then racing them around, you know, these abandoned airfields and the like across the world. And it was, you know, the furthest sort of thing you could imagine from what we now conceive of as professional sport. And obviously, you know, Bernie's great stroke of genius was to recognize, you know, the sort of unlocked value this sport had as a TV property and then to sell that around the world. And, you know, while it's sort of indisputable in many ways that Bernie's sort of model of running F1 had kind of run its course by the sort of, you know, mid 2010s when Liberty Media came in and took over. I think that I think some of the sort of whiplash that some F1 fans, you know, especially the sort of older fans have experienced under Liberty is this sort of clash between what they've done, which is sort of put a very kind of professional corporate sheen on the sport and the sport's kind of roots, as I say, as a sort of like oil soaked amateurish enterprise.
Well, that in a weird way brings us on to that hinge point of the book, which is Abu Dhabi 2021, a race that obviously elicits all sorts of different emotions for different people, for different reasons. That felt like a perfect storm of some of those elements you were just talking about. It was maybe the first really big notable race and season of the Liberty era, but it was at a circuit associated with Bernie Eccleston's time running the sport and between an old champion in Lewis Hamilton and a new one eventually in Max Verstappen. Now, that race continues to cause controversy and debate in Formula One. The tsunami of criticism and controversy after that race had some suggesting this is when F1 became more about television. Some will even say that it was fixed for television, though that's not true. But John, is there an argument to make that this was when, in F1 terms, life started imitating art because of the way it was so much about the spectacle? Like, without detracting from the sporting elements that went into this finale, it felt like, on the other hand, this was the finale F1 was always going to get to that season.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, as you mentioned, the sort of fallout still kind of reverberates through the sport today because it really did epitomize that kind of push and pull between F1 as a sport and F1 as a sort of entertainment product. And, you know, obviously Liberty has achieved a lot of success by sort of embracing the latter of those two ideas, that this is an entertainment product and that fans can interact with Formula One in, you know, many different ways. And, you know, even that it's not really an essential part of being an F1 fan, you know, to actually watch the races anymore. They're more than happy to have fans who will, you know, buy the baseball hat and, you know, watch clips on social media and, you know, devour Drive to Survive, but not actually, you know, sit down for 2-3 hours and watch a Grand Prix. And that's something that they're totally happy with. But I think, again, that speaks to the sort of push and pull between sporting spectacle and entertainment product. And like you say, for many people, Abu Dhabi feels like the moment that F1 jumped the shark. And it felt a little too convenient that this, you know, dramatic conclusion, you know, last lap of the last race of the season was when, you know, the title changed hands. And, you know, even though, you know, I don't think that, you know, even Toto Wolff in his most, you know, incandescent has ever suggested that that is actually what happened. I think, you know, the mere fact that that sort of preys on the mind is evidence of the fact that, you know, what Liberty has done is sort of a double-edged sword. They're treading a fine line. And I think that's, you know, part of the reason that people still get so excited about it today.
I think what I would add on that is also that the part of the reason it became so dramatic is because Liberty gave viewers all of the tools they needed to kind of have access and witness the drama in an unprecedented way. You know, if Abu Dhabi 2021 had actually been Abu Dhabi 2011, I don't think people would have been as outraged because they wouldn't have heard the radio communications with Michael Massey. They wouldn't have heard Christian Horner going nuts over the radio. They wouldn't have heard, no, you know, Michael, this is so not right. All of that came because Liberty had made all of those radio communications available to its viewers, because they had the extra cameras. They even had the camera in the race director's office, which we'd never seen before. So all of those things made it an even better TV spectacle, which, as John says, plays into that cycle of, hang on, this feels weird. What are we doing here? Are we still racing?
Jump the shark is a phrase that I feel like has come to my mind more than once in the last couple of years. I'm not sure what exactly it says about the sport, but clearly I'm not the only person who's thought it. One phrase that from the book really has stuck with me is F1 being a post-sport sport. I felt that really reverberated strongly given certainly where Formula One ended last year. Maybe that's just because the championship wrapped up so early and all we had to talk about were non-sporting matters, really. But it really feels like a phrase that nails Formula One where it is right now. This idea that its modern success is more about sports content than just pure sport itself, if I can make that distinction. But that modern success can't be denied for all those reasons you've already described. But with consumption habits changing really rapidly around the world in sport and media generally, John, do you see this as a virtue or as that being a sign that Formula One sold the soul that you describe in the early chapters of the book of enthusiasts with spanners in oily garages?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the second part of that is a tough question to answer because that sort of depends on what your, you know, what you want F1 to be and what your sort of, you know, goal is in terms of, you know, experiencing the sport as a fan or running the sport as an administrator. But I do think that, that, you know, it's important to note that this post-sport sports idea, the idea, again, that sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier about people not necessarily watching the actual sporting spectacle and yet still sort of becoming F1 fans, you know, interacting with the sport through, you know, the soap opera and the storylines that go on and the, you know, who's driving for who and, you know, all of that stuff is very much, you know, has become very much a sort of key part of fandom, of F1 fandom now. But that isn't unique to F1. I think if you look at how, you know, people here experience the NBA or even, you know, people experience the Premier League, it's very similar. You know, very few people sit down and watch all, you know, 82 regular season games in the NBA. Many people, you know, for many people, the you know, transfer gossip is more fun aspect of, you know, Premier League fandom than actually watching the games. So, you know, I think that this is just a result of, you know, like you say, modern consumption habits, modern, you know, sports viewership, attention spans, all these things, technology, all these things have sort of interacted to create this new sort of class of fandom. And I think that, you know, like I say, the, you know, the benefits and drawbacks of that are sort of something that can be discussed by other people. But I think in some ways, F1 has at least sort of grabbed this thing by the horns and is at least part of this conversation.
And importantly, F1 is also okay with it. You know, no one, you know, in Liberty's offices kind of wringing their hands saying, I think we've lost the soul of the sport, or are we, is that happening? They're saying, you know what, we're perfectly okay with some people are going to buy the hats and interact with the drivers on Instagram and things like that and might never get to watching a race. And that's okay. They're still spending money. There's still eyeballs on the sport in some fashion, and they're still going to talk about it and post about it and things like that. So, you know, for as far as F1's goal, which is really just become part of the global sports conversation again, all of that helps.
Josh, that acceleration from, well, I always hesitate to use the phrase obscurity, I suppose, because F1's always been significant, but there were certainly periods in, I guess, the post-Michael Schumacher era when it seemed like the sport wasn't getting the attention that it perhaps used to enjoy. But that acceleration from that moment in the Liberty Media era to where it is now has been significant. Magic sauce is a phrase that you can really only read in Toto Wolff's voice. It's also chapter 14 of the book, where you talk about this rapid ascension into the public consciousness, into that global sporting conversation, as you mentioned earlier. But the idea that it's a little bit magic, I find quite interesting. A whole bunch of things have obviously gone into F1 being where it is right now, Drive to Survive, that perfect timing of the 2021 championship battle. But is there really an understanding of what's working for Formula One at the moment? Or is there still a degree of F1, I guess, operating on adrenaline, running and hoping that they continue to move forward?
I would say absolutely not. Even Toto Wolff has kind of admitted to us. He says that they still don't really know what was the secret ingredient or if it was all a lucky punch. And I think, you know, the truth is probably somewhere in between. The fact that Drive to Survive, for instance, season two of that show, the first one to include Mercedes and Ferrari, dropped 2 weeks before the in 2020, before the entire world sat on their sofas for a year. You know, that played a part. They had this escapist show that everyone was about to watch and binge, and that did a huge amount for Formula One. They threw a lot of stuff at the wall and to see what would stick. You know, one of the original ideas kind of before Drive to Survive was to create a kind of Universal Studios type train that went through the paddock. Something that Bernie Ecclestone would have absolutely shuddered at, because to him the paddock was the sanctum sanctorum, and if anyone was going to be led into that sacred place, they should at least be made to pay heavily for it. So the fact that Liberty came in and the plan was to open things up and put everything on screen could have missed. They very easily could have misfired, but it happened not to. And so they've grabbed that, and now they're really having to think about what does a post-Drive to Survive future look like for F1? They do things like the Apple project with Brad Pitt and Jerry Bruckheimer. They're adding new races all the time. They're trying to get to new territories. But really, they don't have a firm sense of what the next thing to get them to an even higher level will be. Because there's also part of it, which is part of their objective right now, is to kind of consolidate the rapid gains they've made over the past 5-6 years.
That's right. Even though they don't recognize exactly why it's working, they do recognize that it is working, and the sort of urgency that they feel to sort of capitalize on this sort of unexpected and kind of remarkable growth. And I think you see that in things like, you know, the hurry to make Vegas happen, and the fact that that F1, you know, put on that Grand Prix and promoted it themselves. That's sort of the way that they've tweaked that model is evidence that they sort of recognize that now is the time to sort of cash in on this thing, because who knows how long it will last.
Well, that's where I wanted to take this next, actually, because F1 can't grow forever, if not just because, well, it'd eventually run out of people. It's interesting because this year we seem set for a lot of sellouts at most venues. Australia only a few weeks ago broke its own attendance record for its third consecutive season. But there's also this talk at different levels in the paddock, I got a sense of, that this can't keep happening forever. There is a recognition of that. And that does speak, I suppose, to the idea that no one's 100% certain of why everything's been going so well for so long. So what is the biggest threat F1's continued growth faces, John, in this third year of booming success?
I mean, it's tempting to say, Netflix pulls the plug on Drive to Survive and then they have to sort of start all over again. Because I do think that there's, I think that the success that they've had over the last 5 years has undeniably sort of raised the floor for where F1 is. And even when things do sort of die down a little bit, I think it's undeniably sort of brought, the sort of global popularity and attention to the sport up to such a level that it won't disappear back to where it was again. I think it's established itself as, here in the US, for instance, it's established itself as part of the mainstream sports conversation, and that won't disappear overnight. But I think the biggest question is, so much of the sports success now is that they've managed to, they've managed to elevate not just the drivers right at the front of the grid, but the drivers all the way down, to the very last place, into sort of genuine stars of this sport, something that had never really happened before when all the attention was on the guys who were winning the races and on the podium at the end. And I do wonder what happens when invariably the cast of drivers changes and people who haven't grown to know these guys through a sort of fly on the wall thing like Drive to Survive, like how do they interact with those new characters when they start to cycle it, as happens with any TV show when it's rebooted, when they get rid of old characters and bring in new characters, do viewers at home feel the same connection? And, you know, what impact will that have on the sport's popularity? I think that's the big, you know, big question mark for me.
It's an interesting idea, that new cast of characters, and there are a few parallels in sport I can think of. I can't help but think of tennis as an example, which faces this post-Big Four era, the challenge of which is now to introduce the viewers to a cast of potentially new greats, and I think of MotoGP 2, which I want to talk about in just a moment. But first, John, having pulled off Las Vegas, which happens at the very end of the book, and with three races in the US, and the US having been a major target for Liberty Media after taking over the sport, we've got a maximum of 24 Grand Prix, even there if there's always a rumour that could be broken into a larger number post-2026. In the medium term, what are the targets for Formula One to perpetuate that momentum it's built and that culminated with Las Vegas?
I think the way that F1 sees it right now is that the idea would be to sort of stay at 24 races because they know that any more would stretch the teams too far. Max Verstappen has said that he wouldn't go that far and would completely lose interest if he had to race any more than that. But they haven't ruled out rotation within those 24. So I think they're going to continue trying to expand to new territories. And that is their sort of very short-term possibility for growth.
All right. I want to wrap this one up on a slightly left-field note. It's a timely moment to have a book out looking at the influence of Liberty Media on Formula One, because only a few weeks ago, and a few weeks after publishing the book, Liberty Media announced that it intended to purchase the commercial rights holder of MotoGP, Dorna Sports in Spain. Now, MotoGP is in a really different place to Formula One, especially right at the moment. Josh, it's got a great on-track product, but it doesn't have anywhere near the global attention that it deserves and that Formula One has. So what's your read on this situation? What can Liberty bring to MotoGP, and how big a test will it be for the company, given, as we've discussed, no one's 100% sure what the ingredients are that are working in F1? And in any case, motorcycle Grand Prix racing is a pretty different world.
Yeah, the thing about MotoGP is that the history of MotoGP has actually been close to the history of F1 at various points. And, you know, in 2006, when CVC acquired F1, they actually had to sell MotoGP so that they could buy it. What's going to be interesting now is to see, you know, which of the elements of the kind of modern F1 recipe can then be retrofitted to MotoGP. You know, there are a few easy things: making it a better TV product, making the broadcast more compelling, more accessible. Will they try a Drive to Survive type product? Maybe. I think I wouldn't be surprised if they did. But, you know, I don't think they'll hit the same heights just because MotoGP has never had that kind of F1 style peak in its history. But certainly some of those things that make it more accessible, more attractive on television, you know, could, as John said earlier, raise the floor.
Yeah, I think it will be hard as well, because, you know, while they can sort of try and match, you know, they can try, MotoGP can sort of roughly, you know, replicate the sort of on-track spectacle of F1, and they can try some of the same tricks that, as Josh mentioned, in terms of, you know, making the broadcast more exciting and you know, opening things up and maybe we get Ride to Survive. I don't know that, you know, so much of F1's success is sort of trades on its association with sort of glamour and history. And I just don't feel that, like, I don't feel that MotoGP necessarily, you know, around the world at least, sort of, you know, is associated with those same values in the same way. You know, so much of F1's, you know, so much of the appeal for F1 for so many fans is the glamour and the glitz and that sort of thing. And I just don't think that motorcycle racing, you know, presents that in the same way.
It will certainly be interesting, if nothing else, as a test for Liberty Media, given this would be only its second league or competition level purchase after making such a success of Formula One its first time out. But F1 is ticking along, and its history and its current success is all summed up in this fantastic book you've published. So congratulations on The Formula, How Rogues, Geniuses and Speed Freaks Re-engineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport. You can get it, and I love saying this line, at all good book retailers. So Josh Robinson and Jonathan Clegg, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.
Thanks for having us.
That was Joshua Robinson and Jonathan Clegg, authors of The Formula. If you're looking for a quick start guide to what makes Formula One tick, how it got here and where it's heading, it's a highly recommended read. But it'll be soon time to turn our attention back on track. This weekend is the return of the Chinese Grand Prix, and you can stay up to date throughout the round by subscribing to Pit Pass F1 wherever you get your favourite podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and a review. You can also find us at pitpassmotorsports.com, where you can check out the Pit Pass Motorsports blog, powered by Podium Life, featuring racing articles and motorsport industry news. Pit Pass F1 is an Evergreen podcast. My name's Michael Laminato, and we'll be back in just a few days from Shanghai.
Pit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on!